spent 6 months thinking about our values, because I think one of the worst things you can do as a CEO is to go out and put values out there and then not live and breathe those values. And you look like a hypocrite, and they do more damage than they do good.
Welcome to Technovation. I'm your host, Peter High. My guest today is Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the co-founder and chief executive officer of Worldwide Technology, a global technology solutions provider that reported 2023 revenue of roughly $19 billion. Jim focuses his attention on technology innovation, both for Worldwide Technology and its customers and partners, long-term planning, strategic acquisitions, financial performance, employee development, and workplace culture. Prior to co-founding WWT, Jim played professional soccer, representing the United States on the men's national team in 1984 at the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. I look forward to hearing more about his remarkable journey through this conversation. And now for a word from our partner, Nile, and the company's co-founder and chief executive officer, Pankaj Patel. Pankaj, talk a bit about the idea of network as a service, as this is a category you're pioneering, essentially.
Service is truly the new product. We really wanted to mold this in a way where AI truly drives the closed loop automation, because we saw this as a major hole in the way the networks were today. This is where we realized that data is the secret ingredient for what we are doing. Every facet of our life is dependent on connectivity and networking today. So we will say, before you design any piece of hardware, software, or firmware, ask yourself a question. Do you really need this? Focus on what is truly needed to deliver a service. After you have decided that you are going to need this, simplify it to the nth degree. Simplification is the key. After that, we said, let's automate everything that we are doing. Doing all of this, we were able to simplify and automate 95% of the usual things people encounter in the IT shop. You cannot do this with the product mindset. This is what we had to do in order to create the true service offering.
Thanks, Pankaj. And now on to our broadcast. Jim, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you.
Great to be here, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jim, you founded, co-founded WWT in 1990, just a short 6 years after your time in the Olympics, as I noted in the introduction. Talk a bit about that six-year period and what led you to pivot from being an athlete to an entrepreneur.
I was always interested in business to a certain degree growing up, but obviously I loved the game of soccer, and it was very good to me. Really enjoyed playing, but while I was actually playing, I actually got my real estate license and always was paying attention to what was going on, you know, from a business standpoint, knowing, you know, really didn't know how long that career would last. So fortunately or unfortunately, the league at that time was not in, you know, the best standing, you know, like soccer is today in the United States, is evolved in a significant way. And the team I was playing for went bankrupt, and I had to make a decision whether I try to continue to play and go to other places or get out of the game and get into business. And so that's what I chose to do at that time. And I think it was probably the right decision for me, but it was not an easy one. That was really the transition or the thought process. Always interested in it, but really had no idea what I was doing around tech. You know, I had no experience there.
Before we get into the specifics of the founding of WWT, what advantages were there to being an athlete now as a business executive? What do you draw from that experience that has helped you be successful in the business realm?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of experiences and lessons learned that you get from being an athlete, you know, that still I reflect on today. Just your general work ethic, knowing that you need to put the time and effort in to really hone your skills, whatever it may be, whatever sport, whatever business, you're only going to get so far. And, you know, I was not the most naturally gifted athlete and not the most naturally a gifted student in school. So I had to work at whatever I was doing. And I think, you know, that those lessons learned around just work ethic and also the resilience that's required, you know, to be an athlete. There's a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, I was cut many times growing up as a kid, and your ability to fight through that and continue to persevere. All those things are very important, along with being If you're playing a team sport, just understanding the importance of team orientation and, you know, working with the team and being part of the team and understanding what that ultimate goal is. So many things that I've learned. And then there's also just very simple ones, just, you know, be on time for practice. You know, some of the basic things that sometimes people take for granted, but believe it or not, there's a lot of those basic things that I even see in business today that people don't do. You know, they don't have some of those basic traits. So there's a number of things that I reflect on and don't take for granted that I learned from playing sports and soccer specifically.
Yeah. You grew up in St. Louis. I understand your father was a bricklayer. I wonder if you could talk a bit about your upbringing and the lessons you drew from your parents as well that were also important and formative experiences to the man you become and the leader that you become.
I really do look at my mom and dad really have set the foundation for me and my older brother, Mike, and my sister, Peggy, that, you know, my dad was a bricklayer, a man of what I would say of few words, and but you clearly understood what you were supposed to do and what you weren't supposed to do. And there were consequences. You know, I will just leave it at that. And then I would say my mom provided more of the love and the compassion side of things. So I feel like I've learned really, you know, who I am, how I act, how I behave, values, things that they've taught me just in regards to being loyal to your friends, honesty, integrity, telling the truth, and in different ways, being courageous, standing up for what you believe in. Those types of things and, you know, values and beliefs, I absolutely have received from my parents. And I do not take that for granted because I think sometimes, unfortunately, kids don't get that direction. So I owe a lot to my parents, and we came up from a very, I would say, a humble but middle-class family that I always felt like I had everything I needed and never really needed a whole lot or didn't know any difference at times. Just the basic foundational things that I learned from them are things that I continue to think about today.
Yeah. You co-founded WWT in 1990 with David Steward. Talk a bit about how the two of you came together and how this company was formed.
Yeah, there was actually another individual that was actually part of the founding group at Worldwide, was an individual that I actually worked with about a year and a half when I finished up soccer. It was also an individual that Dave knew. And then we connected, the three of us, this other individual and I were in the tech electronic component space, building out a business plan that was the thought process around Worldwide Technology. And then we connected with Dave, and Dave had another small business. So at that point, we literally came together and said, yeah, this looks like something we would like to do. And reflecting back on that, I would say none of us really knew exactly really what we were doing at that point, but we had an idea of what we wanted to do. And that was more of a value-added reseller. And that's what we set out to do. We had our trials and tribulations in a pretty eye-opening way, I would say, in the first 5 years. Let me put it that way.
How did the idea of being a value-added reseller come to you? And also thinking about technology, where it stood in 1990, very different from today, pre-internet, pre-e-commerce, to say nothing of artificial intelligence and some of the advances that are not only very relevant to the tech world, but very relevant to WWT. Talk a bit about the tech landscape then and the idea to become a value-added reseller.
You know, that's the one thing, if I gave any advice to some young kids coming out of school, and it's something I did think of as I was going through my process of thinking about what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? And I had basically, you know, I played soccer and had a marketing degree from St. Louis University. I had no real tech experience, but I really consciously thought about I wanted to get into the tech field. And the reason was I felt it was a growth space. I didn't know where it was going to go and what opportunities, but I just felt if I could figure out a way to get into that field, that opportunities would present themselves if I worked hard and put my time in. And that's exactly what I did. And it was not easy in St. Louis to find, you know, tech companies. So I found this company called Future Electronics, which was an electronic components distributor out of Montreal, Canada, went to work for them for about a year and a half. and really just kind of studied that market, the electronic components, but wanted to be more into the system side of the business. Computers at that time, you know, which were playing, networking was just starting to evolve with Cisco and Cabletron and Synoptics. That's exactly where I really started reading up on a lot of the system side of it. And that's where we kind of evolved and looked at starting this value-added reseller, which is called Worldwide Technology. And back then it was, you mentioned, very different. IBM, you know, was a massive player at that time. You had these emerging players. You had Hewlett-Packard still in. You had Digital Equipment Corporation, Compaq, Sun Microsystems, as I said, Cisco, Cabletron. All of those kind of evolved over time. But going back to it, probably the best decision I made was to really consciously think about the industry I was getting in and the market, because that space, if you go into another space that is not a growth space, it's hard to pull yourself out of that industry. And especially if you're making decent money, to go and say, I'm going to take this massive step back to get into a growth industry. So, you know, long story longer, it was a good decision to take that time to focus on the industry and then continue to learn from that. And as you mentioned, Peter, wow, has the space evolved over time, just in such significant ways.
I'm looking forward to getting into some of those pivots and how you've ridden a variety of trends successfully. Before we do so, though, I mentioned you're from St. Louis. Your company has always been headquartered in your hometown as well. You now have offices worldwide, Amsterdam, Singapore, Mumbai, among others. But talk about choosing St. Louis. On the one hand, it seems obvious it's where you're from. On the other, then and now, one certainly associates the coasts and especially the West Coast and Silicon Valley as where tech is centered. Talk about the advantages that you've had by being in the middle of the country as opposed to maybe some of the more traditional tech hubs.
Being headquartered in St. Louis has been good. You know, it's something that building out the business right now, again, kind of as you mentioned, the world is very different today than it was in 1990. And you think about, you know, the technology that was just in place and how people worked. Everything, obviously, was in person, you know, and you think about, you're literally walking into offices going back. People were smoking in offices and airplanes and different things, definitely dating myself on this, but a very, very different world. And, you know, the connectivity to different hubs of, call it innovation people, were a bit challenged because they were very geographically dispersed and concentrated in certain areas. But that being said, you know, we built a company that I would say is really based on Midwestern values and really just that kind of work ethic. And I would say building, you know, not only the work ethic, but the trust that we built with our partners and our customers over the years and our employees have been absolutely foundational and critical to our long-term success. So when I look at that and I look at, you know, the building of the company, you know, in the early days, which there's, you know, a lot of those individuals are still here. They're individuals that, you know, are people that I knew and grew up and, you know, were friends. Joe Koenig, who's the president of Worldwide today, was my college roommate, played soccer with Tom Strunk, who's a chief financial officer for Worldwide, you know, joined Worldwide. Tom's been there almost 30 years. Joe, about 30 years, a little over. And you look at those individuals are really the foundation of the company. And we have numerous other individuals that were St. Louis individuals that we really grew up together, really learning this business and, you know, spending a lot of time listening and learning from other smart people and companies around the world. So foundationally, I feel that St. Louis and it's kind of the values of the Midwest have been really valuable and foundational for Worldwide. And now that we have grown to be, as you mentioned, a global company with offices and people all over the world, it's very important. And that's something that I would just say back in the day, you know, we kind of took for granted the values, the culture, and those behaviors that were kind of built in innately throughout the individuals we had. As we got larger, we had to capture that in different ways in regards to our values, our behaviors, and things that we call our IML, our Integrated Management and Leadership curriculum, to really promote that kind of behavior and those values to our employees around the world. And, you know, we're really proud to be recognized, I think 12 years now in a row, as a Great Place to Work by Fortune Magazine, Great Place to Work Institute. So some of those things are really, really important to our success as a business, but also the way that we treat our employees and impact the communities around the world.
And Jim, talk a bit about, we've in a couple of different ways talked about the many necessities to pivot across the time between 1990 and now. And again, to think about, your company was born really before the digital age truly took shape. You talk about some of the companies that were consequential players back then. Some of them no longer exist. Many of them are shadows of what they once were. Some of the leading technology companies that immediately come to mind as the most important today were not yet founded. And so you've been through some remarkable changes, and yet all the while continue to grow and be remarkably successful without going year by year, of course. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the process of staying current and ensuring that the organization doesn't rest on its laurels of current and past successes, but also continues to strive to understand where business and technology are going, such that you're ahead of the wave as opposed to behind it.
Yeah, Peter, it's been fascinating. It really has. If you've been in the business here and you've seen some of this, I go back and look at, you know, some of the companies that I mentioned before. Some have made it, some have not. And some of it, you know, it's leadership, and it's sometimes, you know, just I would say they allow that success to go to their heads, and they lose the humility to ask the right questions and really to watch and see what's going on around them and see how fast things are changing. And sometimes they start believing, you know, they have all the answers. And I can assure you, there's one thing I do know, that I do not have all the answers. I think it's very important to have a sense of humility, but, you know, also to be confident, but not cocky. And so some of those foundational pieces, you know, are critical. And I think leadership is more important today than ever for organizations to survive and thrive. And what I mean by that is, if you think about it, you go back and you look at some of the transitions over the years, you know, the dot-com transition. Back in 1990 and 2000, dot-com bust back then, there were some, you know, massive, you know, transformations taking place then. And there were a lot of companies back then that were just way overvalued. They had irrational business models that just didn't make sense based on the multiples. You even look at where we are today, there's, you know, massive transformation going on, where I'll get to some of that. But I don't think the valuations are anything like today that they were back in 1990 and 2000, when we had this massive, you know, as I think Alan Greenspan said, this irrational exuberance, which he was absolutely right. There were just these valuations that were irrational, and they paid the price, and some of those organizations. But also there were sound organizations that really had opportunity to really take the world, I think, by storm in certain areas. The Sun Microsystems was one that I thought was a really impressive company that kind of lost its way, got acquired by Oracle. But as you go through these, and I look at worldwide specifically, it's really looking at what opportunities present themselves. And you need to be, I would say, willing to cannibalize some of your business, to look at some of those things that nothing should be really considered a sacred cow, because that can be, you know, detrimental to your business. So if you think about the transition of the dot-com, you know, and how that played out, that there was a lot of companies that went by the wayside then. We had to bootstrap ourselves through that process as the overall market corrected. You go into the 2008, 2009, 2010 timeframe, you had the financial crisis. Another massive crisis where if you were over leveraged, you potentially were at risk, because the banks had to really tighten up and the market tightened up and budgets tightened up. So thinking about making sure you take proper, I would say, risk, and you don't put the company at risk, that when things do become a bit challenging, that you can survive those challenging times. But at the same time, What I think is very interesting from if you were going to invest as an individual and as a company, when the market is challenged and is struggling, is normally a great time to invest as a company and as an individual. And picking those solid areas to invest in where the market's going to go, and it's not easy to predict those all the time, I think is very important. So we as a company have really looked at those transitions as opportunities to continue to pick up market share, but also to make investments in things. So as a value-added reseller, if you think about it, you know, in the 2009 and 10 timeframe, where we thought, if any analogy of sports is kind of looking and focusing on where the puck's going and not where it is, you know, we felt it's moving towards software development, mobile apps, digital transformation. So as we evolved and built out more, I would say, of an expansive service offering around IT infrastructure, we also felt that to get out of our space and to expand capabilities we have, we needed to get into software and to help organizations think about where is the puck going and what would they need to do to drive their business and to create differentiated customer experiences, patient experiences, fan experiences around mobile applications. And so that was an area that we saw was an opportunity. You know, it could be viewed as a risk too, but it has worked out quite well for us. You move through that space and you see what's happening here. And I'm obviously moving through 20, 30 years very quickly, but we're seeing some other massive transitions. You know, when you look at what's going on around AI and you see companies that were not even talked about, you know, 10, 15 years ago, well, specifically like this one, NVIDIA, you know, that we look at, you know, they have taken the world by storm. And you can't just jump into that market. Fortunately, 10 years ago, we started investing and we built out a data science practice. And so we've been in that space and it's been more around machine learning and natural language processing. But the generative AI piece that has just hit, you know, has just changed everything and is creating massive opportunities, but is also being a massive disruptor for a lot of current companies and technology companies. So it's one that in some cases, it could be a massive opportunity. In other areas, it could be a big challenge for organizations, depending on how you embrace that and how you lean into that. So I think, you know, one last point I would leave, Peter, would be, you know, when you look at those transitions from my perspective is you need to create a leadership team in an organization that has the discipline and rigor to really understand the importance of operational excellence and execution, financially, operationally, and from a culture standpoint. But you also need to have this balance of innovating and taking chances and risking. So you don't want to chase every shining object that appears out there because that can be very, very destructive to your company. But at the same time, it's that balance of rigor, discipline, and execution, along with taking the proper, I would say, and pragmatic amount of chances around innovating and disrupting yourself, because you will be disrupted by others as technology continues to have such a massive impact on the world today.
And talk, if you would, Jim, a little bit about, as these pivots happen, as you recognize a trend in the ascent that is in a logical adjacency to your own, and therefore an area you'd like to become expert in and develop business around, what is the combination of hiring people who have those skills already, whether from university or in practice, versus building them internally? Is it some combination of those? And I don't know how much it differs across the years, but as you look at some of the most recent trends where actually the people that are most expert are often in high demand and short supply, how do you think about building the critical skills to be able to build the capabilities you described?
You know, on a lot of these things, there's no perfect answer. But to your point, you know, if you look at worldwide, I would say we're a bit unique because, put it this way, a very, very large portion of our overall business has been organic growth. So a very, very small portion of our business has been through acquisitions. And one of the acquisitions I mentioned that we made that I think is very important to worldwide was around software development. You know, we just did not have that skill set. We did some things internally for the company, but we just didn't have that agile programming and that, you know, UX kind of user experience from a true enterprise software development. That's something we went out and we purchased and brought and integrated into the company. So to your point, you know, we're seeing that same thing right now and companies are going to see it. And I truly believe that, you know, generative AI is going to be the most disruptive and impactful technology that we have ever seen, that mankind, you know, humankind has ever seen. A lot of it, I think, to your point, it's going to be there's a challenge to find the right people that have that skill set. And there's just not that many people that have that deep skill set. And there's things that are evolving today around certain pieces of technology that really were not even close to being mainstream around, like vector databases and agents and things around AI that are changing, that your data science team and engineers and consultants and advisors need to be training on this. So a longer answer to your question, I think you're going to need to focus on finding those, recruiting and finding, you know, talented people where you can. But I think you're also going to need to focus on developing those individuals internally. And I think it's going to be a two-pronged approach for organizations. And that's what we're seeing, and we're leaning in aggressively to both. So we are hiring, and fortunately, we've been in this space, and we're also spending a lot of time on training and developing our organization and making sure we're putting the investments into those areas, and our employees know that we are reinvesting back in them around this massive transformation that's taking place, you know, called AI. And there's a lot to it.
Well, talk a bit about your advanced technology center. I know you've made a remarkable investment into AI, putting your money where your mouth is in terms of the opportunity that it represents. Can you talk a bit about the work of the Advanced Technology Center and advances that are being made there?
This is something that I truly am really excited about. And the investments that we're making and the entire executive team at Worldwide is really, again, pumped up about what we're doing. And I would look at it, it's a multi-pronged approach that we have. And as you mentioned, our AI proving ground. So one of the investments that, you know, if I digressed and look back at, you know, skating kind of to where the puck is and trying to figure out how do we add more value, is we built out what we call our ATC, our Advanced Technology Center, you know, 12 or 15 years ago. And that's a technology ecosystem of what was, you know, 10, 15 years ago was one rack of equipment. Now it's multiple data centers and campuses of equipment and buildings of data center type environments around all kinds of things that you would think around complex IT, back office infrastructure, data centers, compute, storage, networking, cyber, voice, video, collaboration, big data science projects. You think about all of those different aspects, and then you take those individual components from hundreds of OEMs, you know, the IBMs, the Microsofts, you name it, all the way down to the emerging tech providers. We take those products and we build them into integrated architectures, and to be able to use those to help customers figure out how they're going to build out their global networks, their global data centers, their voice video collaboration capabilities. And then lean into where we are now is around this AI proving ground. So if you think about where AI is going, it is really changing, and we're all learning as we go forward here. But you have these large language models in the cloud, you know, the ChatGPTs, the OpenAIs. You have, you know, the Microsoft's Azures, you have Google, you have Amazon, and you have others with these large language models. Well, customers are going to, I think, like cloud, are going to take very, I would say, thoughtful approaches in regards to how they do AI. Some of it may be in the cloud. Some of it may be on-prem. Some of it may be done as a hybrid structure or at the edge. And with that being, they need a lot of guidance in regards to what makes most sense for their business. And a lot of that is going to be what we built out in our proving ground, our purpose-built AI platforms. And that is everything from the GPUs from NVIDIA or AMD or Intel, the CPUs, to the storage platforms, to the networking, whether it's going to be a direct integrated platform from an NVIDIA using InfiniBand and Mullinex and some of their networking, or it's going to be an Ethernet approach with a Cisco or an Arista or Juniper. So there's multiple different complex things and evaluations that companies and enterprises are going to need to go through to really determine what is the optimal and the best purpose-built AI platform that they would want to build and deploy across their enterprise if they're going to build on-prem. And then how do they connect to these different large language models to get the data? And then you have to think about, now they have to think about how they're going to govern that data, because it's going to be very important. And what a lot of people are concluding and what we have come to is that not everything's going to be done in these large language models, because you're not going to want to put your proprietary corporate data into those models at times. A lot of it is going to be built on these smaller language models that are going to be on-prem or in the cloud, but they're going to be purpose-built and designed for the specific customer's environment. And so there's a lot of complexity that goes into that. And we have built those platforms from a system and architectural standpoint, but also the business advisors, data science advisors, to help clients think about their strategy around AI, their governance around AI, and what are those use cases? Because ultimately, that's where you're trying to go, is to figure out how are you going to leverage the AI platforms in the cloud, on-prem, at the edge, to deliver, you know, more efficiency, scale, and differentiation for your business. And it's real. This is one thing that, you know, I will say that it's real, but it's going to be a heavy lift. This is not something that can be done overnight. One of the critical components, and I'll stop here and let you see. One of the critical components I would just advise for customers and clients is that you're not going to be able to drive, you know, differentiation, efficiency, and scale if you don't have your data organized. And the data is going to be key for all organizations. And it's, you know, I have yet to go into an organization that someone said, our data is perfect. We got everything we need from a data, you know, aggregation, unification standpoint. There's always areas of improvement, especially when you're looking to leverage, you know, what AI can bring. So these are things that we're doing in our proving ground, and we're investing heavily with our strategic partners, NVIDIA being out in front, and Jensen, you know, has done just an absolutely amazing job of being a thought leader and really taking the world by storm here in regards to, I would say, the infrastructure and some of the operating platforms, along with some of the other innovations that are going on. So it's an exciting time. And my last point I would leave here is, and I've mentioned, I think every CEO and executive team, this needs to be a top priority. And it's not something you can just hand off to individuals because it's too important to your business.
Hmm. Great insights, Jim. Thank you. You alluded earlier to the fact that last year, WWT was recognized by Fortune for the 12th consecutive year as being among the 100 best companies to work for in the U.S. I want to talk a bit about what has led to that. What are some of the ingredients? I know that you take the culture of your organization very seriously, and it's something from which you draw tremendous pride. Can you talk a bit about how you have managed it such to be able to win those sorts of accolades so consistently?
It has definitely been a massive team effort. It's something that the culture of the company has been really important to me, to Dave Stewart, my partner, to the executive teams, you know, like as I mentioned, Tom and Joe and our entire leadership team. Everybody understands the importance of our culture. And if I started out with just one high level message, it's like, do you actually care about your employees? And, you know, you can identify what those values are, but if you truly care about your employees, and it doesn't mean creating an organization, it's easy to work, you know, far and at. You know, we are a demanding company, but I truly believe we care about our employees. And so we had some things in regards to values and behaviors and way we expected people to act that were just kind of part of the smaller organization, say that we were at 100 people or so. Well, as we were growing, that necessarily doesn't proliferate in a controlled enough way that people truly understand what the values, behaviors, and expectations we have. So we built that, we documented those things, and I've spent a lot of time personally with the executive team. And I spent 6 months thinking about our values because I think one of the worst things you can do as a CEO is to go out and put values out there and then not live and breathe those values. And you look like a hypocrite, and they do more damage than they do good. So whatever those values and behaviors and expectations you are, I would advise, think very thoughtfully about those and then make sure you're willing to commit to those. And the example would be if you're looking for team players and you expect people to treat each other with respect and you hire what is considered to be an A performer, an overachiever, but that overachiever is 150% of their number as a sales individual, just using an example. However, they treat people disrespectfully and they think it's all about them. And they think they can just run around and do that. Well, that's not the way it works worldwide. And that individual won't immediately be let go, but they will be sat down and they will be coached up or they will be coached out. And they will not be ignored just because in some organizations, like, wow, I can't get rid of this individual because look what they're doing. Well, look what they're bringing. I'm like, you don't understand how much damage they're doing to your organization and to the integrity of the value system that you've put in place in the culture. So it is very important that those individuals that may be viewed as untouchable, people understand that is not the case. And so I think you really have to lead with those examples. And part of, you know, our process of doing this is to be very rigorous and disciplined about what those values, those behaviors, and those expectations are. And when we hire new people, we make it very clear to them when we are going through that interview process of bringing them on and why it's so important. You always make a mistake here or there, and everybody has a bad day, but we go through that coaching process. And if people don't truly understand what we mean by the values, the behaviors, and how we expect people to behave and treat each other, with respect and with a level of team camaraderie and orientation, then also we train part of our integrated management leadership curriculum, how to have a difficult conversation and how to make a difficult decision. And those types of things, I think, you know, pay off and just significant dividends. And I just give one last analogy. You know, you look at there's hundreds and hundreds of religions around the world. And I don't feel it's my job to weigh in and tell people how and what they should believe from their religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs. But I do believe it is our job as a leadership team to communicate to our organization here in St. Louis and the United States and all around the world, whether it's Singapore, it's London, it's Australia, Amsterdam, you name it, there are a set of values and behaviors that do permeate the world. And we think that everybody can understand that. And when we look at it and say, do we think it's something that we're encroaching on somebody to say, we expect you to treat each other with respect. We expect you to be inclusive of people. And we expect you to work hard and to be, you know, to have that passion and work ethic and team orientation. And when you peel that back, it's like, no, these are universal things. And it's a matter of holding people accountable to them. So sorry for the rambling here, but it is one that is very important to me. And I think has been a huge part of why we are recognized as a great place to work. And as I've said to a lot of people internally, I would rather not have the award and the recognition if we truly weren't doing that. You know, we originally, when we my VP of HR at that point, Ann Marr, who has just retired last year, and she's been a huge, you know, part of Worldwide. We talked about it. I said that I didn't know why we were even, you know, going and enrolling to be a great place to work, because I felt we were. And but doing that was the right thing, because our employees take great pride in that recognition. And it takes a lot of work. You know, every day we've got to make sure that people understand the importance of those things. So anyway, I'm apologize for the rambling there, but it is an important piece of Worldwide.
No, a great description of that as well, Jim. I really appreciate you taking some time and unfolding that story so nicely. I want to also return to a point you briefly alluded to earlier, which is that you've hired friends. And I know that you even think of your executive teams as friends as well. I know there are different schools of thoughts as to the extent to which friends and professional acquaintances, how that mixes or not. You have a strong opinion of that, and I'd love to have you articulate that if you would.
You know, there's a lot of school of thought that, you know, never hire your friends. I disagree with that. You know, you need to go in eyes wide open. And so, you know, hiring friends, when, you know, I've looked at it, you know, I can go back years ago with Joe Koenig and Tom Strunk and others. I said, just understand, we will continue to be friends, but I'm going to put you at a higher level of expectation than anybody else. So you're going to need to be the first one in. You're going to need to be the last one out. You're going to need to be setting the example, because you will be critiqued and you will be watched. And do understand, you know, I need to do the same. I need to lead. I'm a big believer in you need to lead by example. You need to be willing to do whatever you're willing to ask anybody else to do. And at the same time, make it very clear that if you're not doing the job, that I'm going to have that difficult conversation. And it may mean you can no longer be with the company. And we have had to make decisions about people that are friends, are different family members, you know, at different areas, that they just, you know, were not the right fit for the company, maybe didn't have the right skill set, or the company grew beyond them. Not everybody can grow and scale with the company. And that's something that as a leader, you have to pay attention. And those that can't doesn't necessarily mean that they should be removed from the company, but that job is kind of grown beyond them. I've had this discussion with Michael Dell a couple of years ago about, you know, the growth and expansion of, you know, Dell. And I'd say we have similar approaches to this, but this is one that I do believe you can hire and you can build friendships with people, but it needs to be done in a very trusting way. And that's where I believe when you do create that level of trust, wow, you can really create a competitive advantage. And you can make faster, better decisions because you trust each other and you know how each other thinks. And also, when you have that level of trust, you're not second guessing what somebody's thinking. Or they said something that maybe was not, I could interpret that one, two, or three ways. And when those things happen and the trust isn't there, it slows everything down. And you just can't move with the speed that you need to move with when people are questioning, not sure what he said or she said. So I'm not saying it's easy to hire friends. You need to go in with eyes wide open and you need to be willing to have those difficult conversations. But I'll give you one other, Peter, that I would just say that if we treat people the right way, whether they're friends or individuals that we bring in the organization, we bring them in the right way and we treat them the right way, even if they don't work out, some of the most proudest moments I would say that I've had is when we've had to ask someone to leave and coach them out where they're still a fan of the company and the people that were here because they were treated the right way. It wasn't fun. It wasn't an easy conversation for either side through that situation, but they were treated with respect. And the manager and the leader actually wanted them to succeed, but it just was not working out. Not easy to do. But if you go in with that mindset, I think you can work through those situations. And by the way, you know, to your original question, you know, of hiring friends, if you can do it the right way and you create a team that literally has each other's backs, just like in sport, you can do some amazing things. So to put hardcore, I would say, rules in place, not to hire those, you're going to limit yourself from very talented people just because you're saying you don't want to create, you know, some potential bias. So.
Well, we talked through this conversation, Jim, about the importance of your Midwestern roots and the extent to which they have lent themselves to the culture of the organization. We talked about the relationship with your parents and the values they instilled in you. We talked about the importance of sports and teamwork and discipline, all of that and more that you got through your time as a soccer player. I wanted to ask you, is there anything we've missed as you reflect upon the secrets to your success, a career, an extraordinary career by any measure, especially these past 34 years since the founding of WWT? Anything else you would reflect upon that has been a secret to your success, a difference maker along the way that has helped you achieve the heights that you have?
It's something I do reflect back on. What are those things that I try to learn from all? I mean, you know, fortunately, I'm able to interact with a lot of very, very talented people and successful people. I will say some of those incredibly successful people I'm very impressed with, and others I'm not so much, because I think sometimes some have changed who they are because, you know, success has gone to their head and they're not necessarily the same individual that they were. And you don't have to be exactly the same, but I think at times, you know, if you allow success and you think that success is all your own doing, I think you're misguided. And so I think one is to create a real sense of appreciation and gratitude, along with a sense of humility, because you're not doing this on your own. And that's one thing when I look at it, I didn't get here on my own. I got here because of a lot of great people around me and a lot of very talented people. I play my role and I try to do the best job that I can. And I'm, you know, to your point, I'm always trying to learn and reflect and critique my own performance and what I'm doing. So I would say a sense of humility as you grow, and always having, I would say, kind of that kid-like attitude, insatiable attitude for curiosity of always, you know, thinking and asking, because if you really look at kids, they ask fascinating questions. So being able to think about it and asking questions and not thinking you have all the answers. And then one other thing I would just say, as we, I know you're not, but some, we're getting older here, as we get older, you need to take care of yourself and you need to reflect on it. And I've said this as I've communicated at our sales kickoff, just on some things. It is not selfish to take care of yourself. If you're not in good health, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, you're not going to be at your best. So you need to take the time to take care of yourself. If you can take care of yourself mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, do those things, exercise, eat right, try to do those things. It's not about being perfect, but the better health you are in, you know, collectively, the more impactful you can be to others. And you can be a better person. And I think you can be a better contributor. So I think as we get older, we need to make sure that we do take care of ourselves in those ways. And if we can think about how we use, you know, the good fortune that we have to have a positive impact on others, those are things that I reflect on, you know, as I continue to grow and collect more experiences.
Well, Jim, thank you for those reflections and thank you for a great conversation. More generally speaking, it's been wonderful to learn from you some of the ingredients that have led to this remarkable success that you've had and that Worldwide Technology more generally has had as well. Congratulations to you and continued success.
Thanks, Peter. It's been a real pleasure to spend some time with you and look forward to getting to know you better.